lower income countries are now, you know, by far the most polluted. They have air pollution, say, 10 times what it would be in the United States or Europe. That problem is more severe because they have not built the same successful regulatory infrastructure as high income countries have.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In low-income countries, there are often no markets for clean air or drinkable water. So can economics help to create a regulatory structure that could build them? The latest lecture in the BREAD ICG lecture series on environmental economics dealt with the role of and the challenges of environmental regulation. Rohini Pandey and Nick Ryan of Yale gave the lecture. They join me today. Rohini, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Nick, great to see you as well.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for having us on.
Now, we need to establish why environmental regulation is so important in low-income countries. Why is it?
Environment regulation, I think, is very important across the world. That's not limited to low-income countries. Every time you have any economic activity that has some results that are not priced by the market. So for instance, you have industrial production and it leads to pollution, but that's not costed in the marketplace. That leads to negative outcomes for citizens, and you need some form of regulation or some method in order to price it. And I think it's important to remember that this kind of regulation even occurs for just regular market activities. So environment brings in an extra layer that you want to care about externalities. But in general, you can think about many times where how contracts are set up, how laws are done, are all being decided by the state putting in place some legal structure. I think low-income countries, this perhaps becomes more important because citizens often don't have the resources to adapt to those changes or mitigate their effects directly. And so I think the state, through its regulation, is also trying to ensure that the poorest citizens don't suffer more from those consequences. And perhaps that makes it more important.
I think environmental regulation is important everywhere. And one of the reasons it seems more important in low-income countries now is because many high and medium-income countries have had hugely successful regulatory efforts over the last 50 years. So it looks like we don't need environmental regulation in the US or in Europe because pollution is much lower than it was when the Clean Air Act was passed or the Clean Water Act was passed. And those have been so successful that people have become a bit complacent and forgotten why they were introduced in the first place and not understood how effective those have been. And so what you see when you look across the world, lower income countries are now, you know, by far the most polluted. They have air pollution, say, 10 times what it would be in the United States or Europe. That problem is more severe because they have not built the same successful regulatory infrastructure as high-income countries have.
Economists can pat themselves on the back, perhaps, for what they have been able to do for some environmental regulation. We know how to do this. We have the techniques. So in low-income countries, can we just expand this? We can use cozy and property rights, can't we? This is one of our techniques.
This is a very interesting first principles way of looking at the problem, which is, you know, the air is dirty, so who should we assign rights over that air? And then that person can sort of restrict access to their air. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a given cube hovering somewhere over London or over New Delhi or over New Haven. And if anyone wants to pollute in that cube, they have to make a deal with me. The difficulty is, in practice, it's very hard to sort of assign those rights to monitor who is polluting my cube, to trace that pollution back to the source, and then to broker a deal between me and those parties. So in practice, we need governments as intermediaries, and those governments might not have the capacity to do these things themselves. And so in principle, you could assign property rights over air or water and allow people to bargain to an efficient outcome to clean that cube of air above my head or around my head up. But in practice, that becomes very difficult, and what you need instead is government parties to monitor the contents of that cube and everybody else's cube and try to design regulations that approach the efficiency of these kinds of property rights.
The other method that we learn for internalizing these externalities, Pigouvian taxes. Would those work in a case of environmental regulation in this context?
I think if you could implement them, they would hopefully work. I think that's what economics tells us. But how do you identify the extent of activity being conducted by someone to understand exactly what their tax is? I think you need very good information. If you think more broadly about low-income countries, we know that tax compliance is low, tax collection rates are low. So there are the usual challenges of a Pigouvian tax where you're trying to tax a specific activity. And that's made even more complicated when we think about doing it in low-income countries where the tax and the public finance system still needs a lot of work. That's not to say in some ways I think we should give up on it. There are versions of it, for instance, in thinking about carbon tax and others, and many people are trying to think about how it'll become functional. But it's certainly hard to identify both who's undertaking the activity and how much of it they're undertaking.
Rohini made the analogy to revenue-raising taxes. A Pigouvian tax on pollution could also raise revenue. In the standard public finance toolkit, one would recommend a VAT, value-added tax. Mm-hmm. And those taxes have this nice property that, you know, because someone is purchasing from some other party in the economy, you see the transaction from both sides. And that is what allows that tax system to be enforceable, even in relatively low-income countries. But if you think about an environmental tax, there's no other party to the transaction. And that's exactly the nature of the problem. You know, if your tailpipe on your bus or your smokestack on your factory is emitting pollution, there's no other party that is recording in their accounts that I received this amount of pollution from this source. And so that makes these kind of concepts, which are recommended for other tax problems, inapplicable for many environmental externalities.
Even for VAT, and you know, I think Dina Pomeranz has worked on this, it's exactly the last stage when you're selling to the consumer is often where we see least compliance, even in a VAT system, precisely because there is mm-hmm. nothing further on from that.
But if you are a policymaker in these situations, you do need to impose some kind of regulation, some kind of effective and workable regulation in this area. How can economists help them to understand the problem and better solve the problem through their research?
One thing that we emphasize, you want to choose the right regulation, but you also need to understand how you'll implement it. Mm. I think one of the most important things in having buy-in for any regulation you choose is going to be that it is credible, that citizens see or firms see that this is actually a regulation that's working. I think the first time Nick and I and a colleague started working on environmental regulation in India, it was exactly a case where a third-party audit system was no longer seen as credible by either the regulator or by the firms. And so neither party were interested in continuing that system. So I think it's as important to pay attention to the building blocks of regulation, which is how does the regulator get the information? What makes that information credible? And how are they going to ensure that that regulation is followed? And then I think when it comes to regulatory instruments, you have multiple possibilities.
One of the other interesting things we learned from working in Gujarat on these several projects was that you can't separate the monitoring and the implementation from the conceptual aspects of the regulation. To give an example, Rohini described this environmental audit scheme. This is basically a program where auditors report on the pollution readings they find at factories to the regulator. And then the regulator, if they find that these readings are too high, they could, in principle, crack down on the factories and make them pollute less. The difficulty was when the firms are hiring their auditors, anticipating this, they want the party that's going to give them the friendliest report. So right. The problem basically became the information that was conveyed to the regulator was useless. And the question is then, well, what could we do instead? And in that study, we looked at making these auditors more independent, trying to make sure that they had a continued auditing business, regardless of if they were giving the best reports. And that helped those firms to report more accurately, and then the regulator to trust what they were doing. So in some cases, there's a difficulty in incentives. In other cases, it might be in monitoring. But the bottom line is the concept of the regulation might not be working well, and you have to get very close to see the reason why it's failing.
When you're doing this kind of work, how do you know that the auditors are doing a good job and they are reporting accurately what the level of pollution is?
So this question of who audits the auditors, I think, is an evergreen question. And while we were doing the evaluation, we had a system of back checks. So the auditors themselves were being audited. I think That's certainly feasible. I think that's a lot of what you could be doing is having some checks. One thing that we have moved towards in our work since then is to actually see whether we can make use of sort of technological advances to just have ongoing monitoring that happens because you now have probes that can capture the extent of air pollution, mm-hmm. and then you can transfer that digitally. Of course, it still is the case that there is concern of how these instruments are being calibrated. And so you need labs that will do a good job and you need to have them monitored to not have the same problem. But I think you could have some system of infrequent, perhaps manual checks or auditors with high penalties. I think that's one of the lessons from the economics of crime that continues on here is that you want to have high penalties to make the cost of fraud are very high. And I think one can start using technology much more effectively in lower income settings.
With what you were able to do in Gujarat, could you demonstrate that auditing the auditors really did make a difference?
Yeah, so we helped the Pollution Control Board implement these improvements to the incentives for auditors. And our job was basically to evaluate that, to study whether it mattered. This audit program was implemented as a randomized control trial, so we could see some firms that had these independent auditors and others that had the same auditors they hired before. And what we could see is changes in the composition of the reports, so dramatic increases in the pollution reported for the firms that had independent auditors, and also that the pollution reported increased, but the actual pollution, as we measured independently from these same industrial factories, declined. And so that gave us a lot of confidence at the time. Now, Rohini raises the question of ex post on an ongoing basis, how can one have the same confidence? The Pollution Control Board implemented the incentive changes that we recommended to make these auditors more independent than they were before. And we understand it's been perceived relatively well and it's sort of ongoing, but you know, on an ongoing basis, we do not have the same independent measurement. So one has to design the best policy one can and then let it go and let it free and trust that that evaluation carries on.
You point out that a very effective way of ensuring that auditing is done well is just to raise the penalties. Well, we've known about this for a long time. Why isn't this not already the case?
I think there's an offsetting force there, which is that when the penalties become too great relative to the basis of measurement or evidence on which they're based, that creates a lot of incentives to get around that or to divert that. So you can have high penalties to the extent that you have very trustworthy monitoring, but otherwise making the penalties very high could just lead people to circumvent that reporting. So they're really complementary. You need very high integrity of monitoring in order to levy high penalties.
You did mention traffic emissions as an example of environmental pollution that we need to regulate. It would seem to me that this is an absolutely textbook externality. Why do standard methods fail here?
I think the general principle in thinking about transportation is almost what I was describing for the cube of polluted air. It's almost literal in that. Yeah. That case. There are so many sources of pollution and there are so many sort of possible points of intervention. And I think the general principle we're trying to draw out is there are many different ways in which a government might choose to intervene in a given sector or for a given result. And that could be, for example, regulating oil refineries and the content of fuel, regulating the type of vehicles people are allowed to drive, where and when they drive them, trying to clean up the technology in the vehicles themselves, shifting technological generations, moving to electric vehicles. So there's just an incredible diversity of policy choices. And this is where economic analysis can bring some structure to say, look, there are 100 different things you could do. What combination of those things ought you to do here? And what would the costs be? And how much would they bring down pollution?
What do we know from what's being tried at the moment? Because this is certainly something that policymakers are very aware of. There are examples where they have been restricting vehicle use. There are examples where they tax cars according to their emission standards. Are these methods working?
It's something that policymakers are very aware of, but they're also, I think, very aware of the costs of it.
Yeah.
I think trying to affect something like car usage is incredibly political. And so sometimes what you see as a function is activities that governments think will be less controversial. For instance, trying to put something in place at times of very high pollution is often seen as something that's less controversial and has led to a policy which seems to have had mixed to no results, or even car plate use, for instance. So this was done in Mexico City. It's been tried in Delhi and some other places, often put in place when pollution levels are high to say we'll take half the cars off the road. But it's something that if it's going to become permanent, people can respond to by just getting a second car that's a clunker with the driving plate, which is the other number.
And that's probably going to pollute even more, isn't it, if it's a clunker?
The effect seems to be no effect on average, which means that some cars came off and some more polluting cars came on. I think changing, for instance, fuel type upstream, which is something that California has done, does seem to have had some success, or significant success. But of course, it's also made gas prices higher for California, which it has its own politics that it brings with it.
You can see some of the same places that have tried different policies depending on the sort of urgency of the crisis at hand. Delhi, for example, implemented that odd even license plate program, which temporarily brought down pollution, but then was seeking to do something more long-lasting and efficient. And recently, they banned vehicles that were older than 15 years. The economic literature actually would say that you should regulate older cars more stringently because they comprise a much greater share of pollution, and that's sensible. But then you can see immediately the problems that come up. That kind of thing isn't very popular. The average age of a car in the United States is now 14 years. The fleet in India is younger, but there are many people who have cars that are older. And so what you see is articles in the newspaper about people's cars being scrapped and towed away from their apartments and sold off when they were 16 years old, but working perfectly fine. And so if you're going to do something that is more efficient, that is, it might reduce pollution at lower cost, there's these other constraints from what people are willing to accept. And I think that there's a lot that needs to be done on understanding those things. You know, how are the politics feeding into the regulatory choices that cities, municipalities, states are making all of the time?
This is certainly a challenge for researchers in this area, isn't it? Not to just try and think about what is absolutely best, but also what is best and what will work.
And also what is going to actually be acceptable. One of the way these environmental externalities play out is that they're spatially distributed.
Yeah.
So where the polluting activity happens is often not the place where the costs are felt. And so, especially in settings where you may, say, have decentralization or local governments, the local government in the most polluting area may see little reason to put in place a regulation because the cost of people feeling economic activities become more expensive, but not the health benefits, which are often downstream.
And this is something that you covered in the lectures, isn't it? The idea of pollution that crosses borders, as all pollution inevitably does, and how you put in place efficient regulation in those cases.
There are a few very nice examples of this in economics. There are papers on water pollution in China and air pollution in China and water pollution in Brazil, where there are many small constituencies, each of which is responsible for its own monitoring. And what you see pretty reliably is that you don't want to be just downstream of a border, because the upstream county has very little incentive to make sure that what it is discharging across that border is clean. You know, they care to regulate the environment for their own citizens. It might look like you should give responsibility to a higher level of government so that they care about the pollution affecting everyone at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with that is, well, then maybe they will care about everyone's welfare, but they'll be able to do little about it because they can't monitor pollution or they can't monitor the agents that are supposed to be reducing pollution. So this is an area where they're just pretty sharp trade-offs, and it's not obvious before looking at a given pollutant or regulation what is going to do better. You know, regulating it at a very high level or zooming in and giving responsibility to a lot of local actors.
Is this ultimately a political problem where economics runs out of ideas unless the politicians are willing to take it on?
Economics can do a very good job of identifying where the costs and the benefits are and then actually really try to think about what that means for policy design. So by identifying, for instance, the spatial differences in costs and benefits, it becomes clear what kind of possibly redistributive policies you may need to think about alongside. We talked about spatial misalignment that comes in the case of water and air. I think another place where regulation has often gone the opposite direction is when we think of, say, fossil fuel subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
And now when it comes to fossil fuel subsidies, you actually may have the opposite problem, that the rich and the poor are aligned in wanting these subsidies to continue if the rich are responsible for producing some of the fossil fuels and the poor benefit from the subsidies. And there again, I think economics can play an important role thinking about what kind of progressive redistribution policy countries you will need to have at the time of phasing out subsidies in order to have a political coalition that's large enough to agree to go along with the phasing out of subsidies.
And just to add an example, I've studied groundwater rationing in India, where there's a limitation on how much water farmers can pump, but that water is basically free within that limitation. And so there's a political obstacle, which is everybody likes free water. And even if that's costly to their neighbors, that they're extracting too much, it would be difficult to move away from that regime. So there's no economic analysis that's going to make that problem easier for a politician. But what it can do is characterize, as Rohini was saying, who are the parties that are doing well or doing poorly under this regime. And if you're going to move to, for example, a system of compensatory cash transfers, which India has in introducing the PM Kisan scheme for farmers, and which India could do for direct benefit transfers for electricity subsidies, who would you have to target and who would lose from the removal of this free power that you could then offset through a policy alternative? So economics isn't going to take away the kind of constraint, but it can tell you the nature and the magnitude of that and give a sense of whether there are other policies that are feasible and wouldn't really make people worse off and would make some significant share of the population better off at the same time.
It sounds that what we're saying here is that the best regulation is rarely available in these circumstances, and that the job of the economist is to look at what might be second or third best, but to design the best possible policies in that case.
You got it right. It is very much recognizing the fact that you need regulation because you have something that's not priced by markets. But in lower income countries in particular, there are often other markets that are also missing, and that exacerbates the problem even more. And so that's why you may not be in second best, you may even be in fourth best.
The other advice that economists could offer is once you move down that tree and you think I can't do the thing I'd like to do, or even the next best thing and the next best thing after that, one has to take a very hard look at the fourth or the fifth best thing and say, is this doing any good at all? And it might be an inclination that, yes, there's an environmental problem. We have to do something and this is something, so we should do it. But oftentimes that can result in pretty damaging and costly policies that might undercut support for regulation in general. There are famous instances in India, which I know best, and in other places as well, of very coarse policies being adopted, shutting down entire industries wholesale because there was little ability to regulate more finely than that. And these things can have very large benefits, but potentially huge economic costs. And the question is, does that undermine support for the domains where the government is able to regulate more capably and precisely so that it's not so costly to economic activity?
Even if we want to take on this problem, do we have the data? Do we know what's going on in enough detail to be able to make a contribution? Is that a constraint?
Governments make investments all the time to improve the infrastructure for collecting data. And that's part of the decision when deciding on a regulation is what could we do? What is feasible to do? There are technical limitations on that, but it's not the status quo. These are the things that we see now, and therefore that's all we could regulate.
So the government can actually build some markets, right? So if you think that one of the missing markets that prevents good regulation is information, you can actually build a market for information. And that is something that in our work we've seen is maybe one of the more powerful things that governments can do at the same time as they're regulating, is to identify how to improve the information they get.
These are fascinating questions for research, but also in thinking about the problem as well. So thank you very much for talking about it today. Thank you, Rohini.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Nick as well.
Thank you, Tim. It was fun.
If you want to find out more about this topic, then you can find Rohini and Nick's slides on the course pages. And if you want to find those, go to theigc.org. It's pretty easy to find them from there. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. You will find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the papers we feature.